Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, The Tom Woods Show.
My new book, Diary of a Psychosis, is out. It's the most lively, devastating baseball bat to the throat takedown of what the public health establishment did in 2020 and beyond that you can imagine. It's my first book in 9 years, and you're going to love it. Check it out at diaryofcovid.com. And if you've already bought it, make sure also to visit diaryofcovid.com so you can claim your free bonuses, including my free companion volume, Collateral Damage, a collection of stories from real people who suffered under the restrictions. They weren't allowed to tell their stories at the time, but every one of them told me, "We just want to be heard." Check it all out at diaryofcovid.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods Show episode. I'm looking down here because I don't know it off the top of my head. 2442 with the great Scott Horton, who's got every credential in the history of the world. We will say that the Libertarian Institute, would you say that you brought Sheldon on board, but it was kind of your idea?
Yes, I originally created it as an excuse to pay Will Grigg, actually. And the idea was, hey, you know what? You and I could be a thing together. And then I thought, oh, you know what? Sheldon is no longer the vice president at FFF. And I love the guy and he loves me. And so here's what we'll do. We'll be the perfect little triangle of awesomeness here. And then, of course, the late, great Will Grigg stopped living about half a year after that. But that was the origin of the thing, was me and Will Grigg. And then Sheldon was the very quickly, I mean, before the thing was even created, he was on the team right there at the beginning.
All right. So libertarianinstitute.org. Scott's got his hand also in antiwar.com. He's the host of the Scott Horton Show with 8 gazillion interviews he's done over the years. Antiwar Radio.
Hey, let me say, this Thursday, I'll hit 6,000.
I'm right now. Get out. Oh, that's tremendous. Congratulations to you.
Thank you. Thank you.
That is really, really tremendous. And he is the author of Enough Already, which is the definitive book on the war on terror. I mean, honestly, just one place after another, it gives you the whole story and you get the ins and outs of it. Fool's Errand, endorsed by Noam Chomsky. Do with that as you will, is his
and
book
McGregor
on Afghanistan.
Where Colonel McGregor and Noam Chomsky agree is on my book.
Yes. How about that? Of all things that they agree on, it's going to probably be a Scott Horton book. So I thought, you know, I'm looking, I'm seeing Yemen back in the headlines, thinking, can't they leave this godforsaken country alone? So I want to talk about the Biden airstrikes. And I read the statement that Biden made, the official statement, explaining why this was done. And it was in tandem with our partners and blah, blah, blah. But he's making an argument that would certainly appear reasonable to most people, that there are people who are disrupting the flow of commerce through the Red Sea, and we just can't stand for that. So we've intervened for that reason, and we stand ready to continue doing so until peaceful passage is restored. So talk to me about this, Scott.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, I'm a boy. I like explosions and loud guns and things. So like, just like on the basic level, if we can use our Navy to shoot at something like that, sort of seems fun. And if we have an excuse to do that, I can relate. I'm like, okay, we get to do a thing. I used to be 15. I supported Iraq War I for those exact reasons. Okay, but for grownups, the obvious question is lying right there. It's not even raised. It's there from the beginning. What other options might we have other than using violent, deadly force? And of course, the answer is, well, we can negotiate. Or we could check out, just for example, what are the Houthis' motives here? It's clearly and clearly stated backdraft from American support for Israel's war in Gaza, something that we shouldn't be doing anyway, something that Israel shouldn't be doing anyway. So how about we just stop doing what we're not supposed to be doing anyway and short-circuit the Houthis' motivation for launching these missiles in the first place? As I love to point out, 9 years ago, our current Secretary of Defense, I mean, when he shows up for work, Lloyd Austin, was then the commander of CENTCOM, and he had a very short-term alliance with the Houthis and was passing the Houthis intelligence to use to kill al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, the guys that tried to blow up the underpants bomb and blow up the plane over Detroit on Christmas Day 2009 that did the Charlie Hebdo attack in France and a few of those other massacres in Europe, tried to blow up another plane or two with onboard bomb plots you know, these are not Al-Qaeda linked fighters somewhere. These are real ass Al-Qaeda terrorists who have at least attempted to shed American blood and certainly have shed a lot of innocent blood in Europe. And well, and their kind of predecessors are the ones who bombed the USS Cole, of course. So the Pentagon was passing the Houthis, who are Shiites from the north of Yemen, intel to use to target and kill a QAP. And that was confirmed with great reporting from the Wall Street Journal and Al Monitor, and based on the statements of Deputy Secretary of Defense for Intelligence Michael Vickers in a speech that he gave at the Atlantic Council. And then the Wall Street Journal had it confirmed on the Houthis' end as well. And this was all going fine until Barack Obama and Lloyd Austin stabbed the Houthis in the back and took Saudi and Al-Qaeda's side against them in the late horrible war that's just now coming to an end, Tom. I don't know if you saw this headline on antiwar.com, but the Saudis are complaining to the Americans.
Would you
please cool it? We're right in the middle of ending the last war, and you guys are starting a new one here.
Yeah, I saw it because I hadn't been to antiwar.com in a little while, but as soon as this news broke, I immediately went there. And then I actually, for the first time, I've never used this feature before, Scott, but as you know, on antiwar.com, because in order to keep track of all the interventions, it's, you know, can get complicated. There's a little drop-down menu you can use, and you can just list your country. What country do you want to find out about is, you know, this getting attacked? So went right down to Yemen, and I got all the news items. So I feel like I have a pretty good handle on what's been going on. But yeah, great. So to see that, to see the Saudis saying, maybe this thing is actually winding down, and then we have Biden's intervention. But the thing is, from Biden's point of view, if you make all of Biden's assumptions, then this is the right thing to do. If you make all the assumptions that, of course, we can't do any of the things Scott Horton just recommended. And so since we can't allow them to do what they're doing in the Red Sea, we have to intervene.
Yeah. Well, look, let me attack the Kissinger from the Kissinger. I mean, the Rand Corporation put an article in Foreign Affairs saying exactly what I just said. We can negotiate. We don't have to fight. By the way, dropping bombs on the Houthis doesn't work. John Kiriakou told me, the CIA officer, the first drone strike against the Houthis that he knows of that the Americans did was in 2005, back when we're still backing Abdullah Saleh in his multiple failed wars against the Houthis then. Those wars against the Houthis only empowered them to the point they ended up being able to take over the capital city. Then just now, as we're discussing, we've had this late, horrible war for the last 9 years since they seized power, backing Saudi and UAE against them. And it didn't work. The reason when we're talking about Saudi is ending the war, that means Saudi's giving up. I mean, Saudi did not get their regime change and it cost them too much. And so now they're saying, forget it. And so Joe Biden and I guess, how do you say the guy's name in Britain, the prime minister there, Sun Yat or whatever.
Yeah.
They're just dropping a bunch of bombs on, it might as well be empty fields. They could take out a warehouse of some missiles here, some launchers there. It doesn't make a difference. They have, you know, a second world military force that America and the Soviets and the Brits at different times had helped build up in the past. And so they're not going anywhere. I mean, when Biden launches missiles at them, that doesn't mean they're going to stop. And the headline today is they hit an American ship, a civilian ship. By the way, they had only been targeting Israeli shipping before. Now, after America and Britain targeted them, they've declared open season on American and British shipping as well. And one of their missiles hit an American cargo ship today. They didn't sink. They weren't badly damaged. It was their cargo area got hit, they said, and they sailed on. But anybody could see how this could escalate to a terrible war. It would take a few lucky hits to actually sink one of our ships, well, especially one of our naval ships, but you never know. And again, what's the context? Why are the Houthis even doing this at all? They claim that they're actually living up to their signature of the Genocide Convention. They're obligated to take steps to prevent genocide when it's taking place in front of their eyes. And they say that that's what's happening in the Gaza Strip, and they're doing something about it. Meanwhile, what's America doing? Vetoing UN Security Council resolutions demanding a ceasefire and continuing to ship bombs to the Israelis on an emergency basis so they don't even have to consult Congress, who we all know would give them a rubber stamp anyway. And while expressing concern every other day or so, they continue to ship them all the bombs they need, including 20,000-pound bombs that they're using to just blow the people of the Gaza Strip to pieces. And so I'm not justifying what the Houthis have done. at any time, really, other than just resisting Abdul Saleh's attacks against them way back years ago. But they became a state when they seized that capital city. I'm certainly not on their side. And, you know, there's a Yemeni journalist that I know named Nasser Arabi, who I've been interviewing for years. And anyone can go and listen to the archives there, where I'm basically chewing him out as though he's the Houthis, the poor guy, which he's not. But I'm saying, look at what you're risking here, because you get to be macho and beat your chest and whatever, but you're not really helping the Palestinians. You're not stopping what's happening to them at all. And you're risking, if you zoom out and think about what's happening in the region, you're risking escalating Israel's war in Gaza into a regional war by the United States and Israel against Iran's Shiite alliance. And since the start of this war, we've seen strikes back and forth with Israel and Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, as well as more than 130 strikes, allegedly and I guess believably, by Shiite militias against American forces in Syria and Iraq. Tom, 130 different attacks, and with dozens wounded, mostly from concussions, I guess, but nobody killed yet. But you know what? In one of these, almost certain it was in Iraq, a drone flew in the window of a barracks where there were like 15 of our soldiers in there. And then the thing was a dud and it didn't explode, but it could have killed them all. And so our guys are at risk in Syria and Iraq. And then, of course, the way that the narrative holds it, which is somewhat true, is that the Ayatollah in Tehran is nominally the boss of this Shiite alliance, the Axis of Resistance, they call it. And since all the Sunni leaders in the region are all the sock puppets of the Americans and the Israelis, especially the Americans, they have to just stay quiet and basically sit this out. So they're kind of ceding the whole field to the Shiites to be the only ones sticking up for the Palestinians. But then that is a pretty significant combination of groups that if the war truly escalates beyond where it already has, we could be looking at reintroduction of American combat forces into the Middle East in large numbers, or at least some severe air campaigns or this kind of thing. I remember George W. Bush put Iran's best friends in power in Iraq in 2003 through 8 or through 11 there. And they've been trying to make up for that ever since, that they have empowered the Iranian slash Shiite alliance in the region by 300%. Now they're stuck dealing with that.
Can we just go back to something you said, just because I'd like to get your thoughts on it. And I know that this could take us a little far afield, but since, as you say, this is how the Houthis are in part justifying what they're doing, can we say something about the issue of genocide? Because
yes, please.
This word began to be used pretty early on in the Israeli assault on Gaza. And there were some people who were saying that genocide has a very precise meaning, and that if Israel wanted to, it could probably wipe this whole people out if it wanted to. It wouldn't be dealing with the numbers that we're dealing now. We'd be dealing with much, much larger numbers, and it could do that anytime it wants to, but it's not doing that, so it's not a genocide.
Well, look, first of all, it's the other Scott Horton, who's the international human rights lawyer, who wants to parse these things. Personally, Tom, I try to be very conservative about, maybe not overall my attitude. I can be very hostile. I'm not denying that, but I try not to be like inflammatory and use always the largest estimate of casualty numbers or use like the most inflammatory rhetoric and all of that kind of thing. I'd rather just let the facts speak for themselves. And quite frankly, like personally, when you say genocide, I, like everybody else, I think more or less, I think of the Holocaust or like the Turks' war against the Armenian population after World War I, this kind of thing, the annihilation of an entire nation of people. But so the problem is there's a discrepancy here where in the law, you don't even necessarily have to kill anybody. So in the law, I think you and I spoke, didn't we, a little bit about what the Azerbaijanis just did in Artsakh or Nagorno-Karabakh, where they ethnically cleansed the very last of the Armenians out of Nagorno-Karabakh and into Armenia. And there were some people who were calling that genocide because it is essentially completing of the destruction of the Armenian mini little sub-nation of Nagorno-Karabakh there. That civilization has been destroyed, even though they were essentially just force marched out at bayonet point, but not massacred. I don't think anyone was killed, I think. We're talking about last fall. just in at the end, second half of 23 here, I believe was September or October. So must have been September, I guess. And then the statute is adopted, you know, it's the Rome statute that's adopted on the Genocide Convention, and it has all of its own stipulations and points and that kind of thing. Personally, in terms of just rhetoric and talking about it, I don't really refer to it as genocide. Like, I don't think I'm going to sit and argue that it's definitely not one, but ethnic cleansing, although I hate that term because it's such a horrible euphemism, but, you know, you understand what it means, is they're forcibly removing all of these people. And I would strongly urge you and all of your listeners and viewers to go to YouTube and watch the South African government's case at the International Court of Justice that they put on the other day. It's about a 3-hour long presentation. I'm almost finished with it. A huge part of it is discussing the intent of the Israeli government, as stated by numerous Israeli government officials, including Benjamin Netanyahu himself, the prime minister, has said, one, that the enemy is Amalek, and has referred to, in one time, in a letter to the soldiers, referred to Amalek and said, remember what you're supposed to do. In the Bible, God says to the ancient Israelites that they are to kill every last member of the Amalek tribe, including the infants and their animals and everything else. And as well as he has said that he is looking for other nations of the world to, quote, absorb the population of Palestine. And then down from there, you have his finance minister, his interior minister, all different members of the ruling Likud party from the Knesset, and they have the whole list. And people can read also, if you pull up the PDF file of the South African's complaint here, they have a whole section where they have collected, I don't know if it's exhausted, but it's an incredibly detailed list and long list, if not completely exhaustive, I think exhaustive anyway, list of Israeli government statements making clear their intent, repeatedly calling the people of Gaza, the Palestinians of Gaza, animals, and calling them all guilty, and explicitly denying the possibility that any Palestinian human in the Gaza Strip is not outright as responsible for what the Qassam Brigades, the armed wing of Hamas, did on October 7th as the men who did it themselves. And they say it explicitly over and over and over again. At the same time, they are bombing, as they call them, power targets, which includes journalists and doctors and civil society leaders and their families. And if you watch the South African presentation, they show numerous, I don't know what, maybe just a half dozen, but it's impressive enough, clips from TikTok of Israeli soldiers filming themselves laughingly detonating entire neighborhoods at a time. You can see them going up in explosions and smoke in the background there as they are completely decimating the entire civilian infrastructure. And I think the UN says it's 70% of the buildings in Gaza have already been destroyed. So they are deliberately making it so there is no Gaza to come back to as the people are pushed further and further south. And then you see them targeting hospitals, ambulances, churches, shelters, refugee camps. And, you know, on Christmas Day, they slaughtered a Waco massacre worth of people, 78 people. They dropped a giant bomb on a refugee camp on Christmas morning. And this has gone on and on and on and on. And so, again, I'm not the lawyer, but the South African's case is, look, we don't have to get up here and prove that the Holocaust is already over and that Israel is guilty of committing a genocide. That's not the standard here. What we're saying is that their behavior and their statements make it reasonable to conclude, I think I wrote this down, it makes it a plausible claim, Tom, that their intent here is genocide. And so then based on that, see, this is not the ICC criminal court and we're saying Netanyahu's going to prison. That's not what it is. It's the International Court of Justice, which is essentially, it handles civil suits between nation states. So South Africa is taking Israel to court and essentially asking the court for an injunction, what they call provisional measures. They want the court to impose provisional measures, which is essentially to command Israel to stop the killing of what they're doing based on the plausible claim that essentially, in fact, the way they say it is, we don't have to convince you that the way the statute is written, we don't have to convince the judges that the behavior and language definitely show an intent to commit genocide. We just have to show that you couldn't rule that out as a plausible interpretation of what is happening here. And quite frankly, I mean, we see them say over and over and over again. I mean, Tom, they had two ministers were allowed to write an article in the Wall Street Journal saying, you take them. You love the Palestinians so much, then help us finish removing them from their homes. And we're talking 2 million people here. And, you know, I looked it up. The Trail of Tears under Andrew Jackson, when the Georgian government marched the Cherokee to Oklahoma, that was only 40,000 people. That's absolutely nothing, which is one of the worst scars on, you know, the first century of America's founding that people like widely agree on, like one of those horrible shames of America's ethnic cleansing of the natives as they created their new nation here. Just merciless oppression and brutalization of these people. Well, that's nothing. 40,000 people cleansed, and the Israelis accomplished that within the first week of this thing back in October, probably. It's much worse than that. And for people who have the stomach for it, Tom, I think it really is somehow exactly, I mean, whatever. It's obviously Joe Biden's responsibility. But as Americans, you know, I wouldn't put it really on anyone else. I feel like it's a responsibility of mine to bear witness to this. And I encourage people, they have the stomach for it, to just go put Gaza in your Twitter search results and just go look at the pictures coming in and look at the footage coming in of these people carrying the pieces of their dead relatives to and fro, burying them in mass graves, people buried alive. We're not talking about little single family homes here, right? We're talking about mostly 4 and 5 story concrete buildings. And as the Israelis bomb them, people are stuck in those void spaces on the inside, right? And they're buried alive. In many cases, you can see people's hands sticking out and they're crying, help me. But nobody can help them. Nobody's coming. There's tons of rubble buried on top of them. And you see the guy's hand sticking out or the woman's hand sticking out. And they're just stuck in there. And there are, right now, there are more than 7,000 people MIA, which means buried alive in the rubble or buried to death in the rubble. And then the Israelis come in with bulldozers and just wipe the place clean. So a lot of those people are never even going to be identified at all. They're just being pulverized. And that thing is absolutely horrifying. And, you know, you could have lived your whole life and been a hardcore pro-Israeli partisan and think them Palestinians are nothing but a bunch of beasts or whatever. But you could change your mind now. You could look at this right now and go, you know what? This is not what I signed up for. You know, you look at that case. Again, I urge people to watch the case that the South Africans present at the International Court of Justice here. And I'm not a one world commie type. We can talk about all this international law stuff in a minute, Tom, because I have a lot of mixed feelings about all this. But still, what I'm talking about here is just the presentation. And they show these soldiers and they're all dancing and singing about how there are no innocents in Gaza. This is our mandate. There are no innocents. They are all Amalek. They're parroting their prime minister. They're all Amalek. We're going to kill them all. There are no innocents. And I would just ask you to imagine American Army soldiers or Marines jumping up and down and chanting and singing, there are no innocents. Let's go and kill them all, citing the Old Testament, that it's okay to go and kill all the people of Iraq, all the people of Ramadi or Fallujah or Mosul or, you know, in the Nineveh province or wherever. That's not how America waged Iraq War II. And it was brutal. And 1 million people were killed overall in that civil war. And directly by America, I don't know, 100,000. It was a horrible war. But we don't fight. Our guys don't fight the way the Israelis fight. And I've seen, you know, on Twitter, this has come up over and over again, where people go, well, I don't know. They're our friends. They're our allies. They just kind of project American standards onto Israel. But look at what they're actually doing. And look at this article in 972 Mag, where they talk about what's called the assassination complex and where they're using artificial intelligence. The article is called The Assassination Complex, and how they have the quotes in there from Israeli officials themselves, military officials themselves. When they blow up a house with a 4-year-old girl in it, they know there's a 4-year-old girl in it, and they're making that call. They're saying this is like if, you know, Hamas, if they had guided missiles, when the IDF soldiers go home on the weekend, Hamas comes and blows up their house and kills them and their family. And that's what they're doing here. Anyone who's a member of Hamas, which, by the way, Hamas is divided between the political and armed faction, sort of like the IRA and Sinn Féin, you know what I mean? So, but they're killing anyone who's a member of Hamas and their families, anyone who's even accused, anyone who's nearby, and they're killing journalists. There have been more journalists killed. I think, I forget the number now, but you can look at the Committee to Protect Journalists. They are clearly, and they admit this again in the Assassination Complex article. They admit this, that they're deliberately targeting journalists and their families. And including when they know the journalist isn't home. The journalist is live on TV. They bomb his house and kill his wife and babies. This is really going on. They're citing the Old Testament, saying God says kill everybody. So look, whether you want to call it a genocide or you want to coin a new term for it, or you want to call it just an absolutely brutal ethnic cleansing campaign or some kind of thing, it's a dirty sin. I know that. It ain't right. And anyone can look at it and tell you that it ain't right.
Hey, folks, Tom Woods here with a message from Bank on Yourself. Are you being lied to? Wall Street tells you to put your money in an IRA or 401k. Yet studies show the average American who follows that advice will outlive his savings by 10 years. Bank on Yourself is a better way to grow and protect your hard-earned money. This retirement plan alternative has never had a losing year in over 160 years. With Bank on Yourself, your plan doesn't go backward when the markets tumble. Your principal and growth are locked in. You'll know what your tax rate will be in retirement. Zero under current tax law, which protects you from the coming tax tsunami. And you're in control. You get access to your money for any purpose with no questions asked and without government penalties or restrictions on how much income you can take or when you can take it. Try doing that with a 401k or IRA. Do you want guaranteed, predictable annual growth, control of your money, and tax-free retirement income? Then go to bankonyourself.com/woods, and we'll send you a free report with the proven retirement plan alternative that banks and Wall Street are desperately hoping you never hear about. Just go to bankonyourself.com/woods for your free report. bankonyourself.com/woods. Scott, going back to the Biden and Yemen situation,
yeah.
Would you therefore say that what's going on right now with, I mean, I didn't see this coming. And then I read this headline that Biden has launched this campaign. Is this just a matter of, this is just, if you're going to play the empire game, one intervention leads to another, kind of like domestically, one intervention leads to unresolved problems. So to resolve those, they come up with a new bit of legislation and that doesn't resolve it. So then they come up with something else, which creates other problems. So in other words, the U.S. Israeli support now yields this problem, the Red Sea, that they'd have to go fix. And it just, either you go back to the root and you just knock it off, or you're just going to have endless problems.
Yeah, that's the deal. And look, that's the story of enough already right there. And you can say, oh, well, you want to appease terrorists or whatever. But the point is, we shouldn't be doing any of this stuff anyway. You know, Eric Margolies told me this story, and I have Frieda Utley's book here about the Middle East. Will the Middle East go west? I can't wait to read that. But I know from talking with Eric Margolies, I think I told you this before, his mom was like this Lois Lane type character who, after the war, after World War II, went traipsing around the Middle East, interviewing all the sultans and potentates and everybody. And the basic temperature was they all loved us. They all loved us because America had defeated the evil British and had overthrown and force the British off of our shores, which is the direst wish of all of mankind, that they could emulate the American success at that. And, you know, Darrell Cooper talks about this in Fear and Loathing, that after World War I, they wanted Woodrow Wilson and the Americans to come and take over the Middle East instead of the Brits, because they knew it was going to happen if the Brits did it. And they hoped that the Americans would treat them fairly somehow. So it's just not the case that we're just destined to be in conflict with these people because our society is a Christian one and theirs is a Muslim one and this kind of thing. It's not inevitable. It's almost all of it is a result of American support for Israel. And this isn't to oversimplify it because, look, I'm an individualist and every American involved in the policies they've been involved in this whole time, they bear responsibility for what they do. Not all of them are neoconservative Israel firsters. You know, George W. Bush and his people certainly had their own agenda. Same for Obama and what have you. The arms dealers have their own agendas. Everybody's responsible, the officers and who want their promotions and the rest. They all have their responsibility for it. But, and quite frankly, American support for Israel completely skews and screws up American foreign policy. And, you know, a great example of that is Iraq War One, where I don't think Mearsheimer and Walt make this case, but they should have gone through. I wish I'd done a better job of it. But you can see in my treatment of Iraq War One that who were all the biggest hawks on getting us into Desert Storm? You could go down the list. It's the very same neocons, especially in the press, who pushed so hard for Iraq War II, Charles Krauthammer and all of those same guys who pushed for it. And then in the case of Iraq War II, it's absolutely indisputable that the neoconservative movement, they created what Colin Powell called a separate government inside the government under the control of Dick Cheney. And it was all these neocons in the vice president's office, on the National Security Council, state, and at defense. And then, of course, throughout the media and all the think tanks to push us into that war. Oh, I skipped one that I wanted to say. After Iraq War One, Tom, Bill Clinton, he had stupidly said out loud that he wanted to normalize relations with Saddam Hussein and bring him back in from the cold. And maybe we can get along with the Iranians too. The revolution was a long time ago now. Well, he should have kept all that stuff very close to his vest. And what he did was he alarmed everybody, namely the Kuwaitis and the Israelis. So the Israelis were pushing hard. This is Yitzhak Rabin, was pushing hard for what they call dual containment. And because remember, Ronald Reagan's government had backed Jimmy, starting with Carter, but then Reagan especially had backed Saddam Hussein, while the Israelis had mostly backed the Ayatollah in the Iran-Iraq war in the 1980s and kind of kept them at parity and kept the war going. But then at the end of that war, of course, Iraq, with the encouragement of the Americans, invaded Kuwait. And then with the encouragement of the Brits and Israelis, went and kicked Iraq right back out of Kuwait again. That's Iraq War One, Operation Yellow Ribbon, Desert Storm, the war in the Gulf, etc. And then what happened in that war? Colin Powell's army beat the crap out of Saddam Hussein's old Soviet tanks and so forth, right? Completely obliterated. So then that meant in the aftermath of the war, Iraq was no longer strong enough to contain Iran on its own. So the Israelis said, even though they had helped push for all these policies, the Israelis insisted America has to stay in Saudi to contain Iraq and Iran both. And it was Israel Shamir's aide, the Likudnik, his aide, Martin Indyk, who came and worked for Bill Clinton. He was the founder of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, which is a spinoff of the American Israel Public Affairs Committee. And it was at WINIP that he gave his big speech announcing the dual containment policy. And I mentioned the Kuwaitis were alarmed. The Kuwaitis took a whiskey smuggling ring and embellished it into a plot to truck bomb George Bush Sr. to death. Remember the fake assassination attempt against H.W. Bush that Bill Clinton shot a bunch of cruise missiles at Baghdad and killed Leila Al-Attari, I think it was her name, the Iraqi artist. And that was totally fake. Seymour Hersh debunked that. In fact, if you just search my Twitter, I posted screenshots of the entire archive of the old New Yorker article where Seymour Hersh totally debunks this fake plot against Bush Sr. But once that story broke out, finally Bill Clinton relented and accepted Israel's dual containment policy. And then, as everybody knows, because Ron Paul done told us and Rudy Giuliani too, it was America bombing and blockading Iraq from bases in Saudi Arabia for 10 years before 9/11. That was the proximate motivation, the primary motivation of the bin Ladenite forces turning against their former masters and even current masters and knocking down our towers on September 11th. And then, of course, as I mentioned there, with Iraq War II, as soon as the towers came down, what'd they do? They said, we got to go to Iraq. The Project for a New American Century immediately wrote a letter to President Bush saying, if you don't go to Iraq, we're turning on you. No war on terrorism can be complete without a regime change in Baghdad. And then full court press. And who are the neocons? They're the Israel lobby, Tom. That's who they are. They're the vanguard of the Israel lobby, running think tanks paid and financed by Lockheed and Northrop Grumman and General Dynamics and the rest. And so not that America wouldn't be a world empire without Israel. Not that America wouldn't be soaking in blood from the war somewhere or another. Anyway, if we still had Bushes and Clintons running this government, then I'm sure it would have been bad. But you can definitely see where Israel's influence on American foreign policy helps to make everything much worse. And then, yes, it is simply dominoes from the Iran-Iraq war in the 80s and supporting the Arab-Afghan army in Afghanistan in the 80s, to then the aftermath of Iraq War I. Well, in fact, Iraq War I coming as the aftermath from the Iran-Iraq war, as that war was partially fought over war debts from the previous war. Then American containment policy, Iraq War I and a half, helped lead to the Al-Qaeda war against the United States, where the guys our government had backed in Afghanistan then turned against us here, started attacking us all through the 90s, and then including September 11th. Then they did not have to, but they certainly went to Iraq. And then from there, all the dominoes fall down. Because in Iraq War II, one, they score this giant own goal, as they call it in soccer, right? When you accidentally kick the ball into your own net by putting the Ayatollah's best friends in power in Iraq. And also, by doing so, driving the Sunni population of Iraq into the arms of Al-Qaeda and becoming completely radicalized and in religious and political terms, and fought a horrible civil war, which in the aftermath of Iraq War II, then you had a bunch of these jihadists go home to places, Tom, like Libya and Syria, where then Barack Obama took their side. And Libya was not so much against the Shiites, but, you know, the Israelis and the Saudis, they hated Gaddafi for whatever other reasons anyway, insulting them and ripping them off on oil deals and whatever. But then the war in Syria was really meant, as we talked about back 10 years ago during the thing, the war in Syria was really, which entailed essentially America and its allies, including Israel and Saudi and Qatar and Turkey, backing Al-Qaeda in Iraq in Syria in an attempt to regime change Bashar al-Assad. We put Iran and the Shiites up a peg in Iraq. We'll try to take them down a peg in Syria. And that led to the rise of the caliphate, because instead of going west and overthrowing Assad, they went east and took over all of eastern Syria and then all of western Iraq and declared their caliphate, which then led to Iraq War III, which Obama, of course, launched in 14 and Trump ended up finishing in 18. But then, see, after the regime change in Syria failed and it built into the caliphate, America put pressure on Saudi that, hey, man, enough of this, back in Al-Qaeda in Syria. And then I think it was, I forget the date, I'll have to check the date, Tom, but the king of Saudi died and bin Salman became the king and I think decided, okay, we'll back off in Syria, but we want to fight the Houthis in Yemen. And see, remember the whole thing, as we talked about when the war against Yemen started, they wrote it right in the New York Times. We have to placate the Saudis, partially because they're mad at us because we gave the Shiites Baghdad. So we weren't able to take Damascus away from the Shiites, which the Alawites, the Assad family are Alawites, which is sort of a breakoff, sort of an associated group with the Shiites there and an alliance with the Shiites there. So then, well, maybe we'll help you limit Shiite influence in Yemen. And that was where, of course, the drone war. Oh, and of course, the drone war in Pakistan had helped to drive the last few Al-Qaeda guys hiding there back home to places like Yemen. And so now Yemen starts getting hotter again. Obama drives up the drone war there in 2000, especially in 2010 and 11 and 12. And in doing so, one, he makes Al-Qaeda more powerful, but two, he bribes the dictator, Abdullah Saleh, into letting him do these attacks against Al-Qaeda there. He bribes him with money and guns. And Saleh takes those weapons and uses them against Ansar Allah, the Houthis, this group of Shiites up in the north. And he attacks them six different times, and they beat him six different times. As I document in my book, though, he was playing a double and even triple game, because he was, the same time he's letting America bomb Al-Qaeda, he's actually backing Al-Qaeda and the Muslim Brotherhood as auxiliaries to his army fighting against the Houthis. But then he's also betraying all of them and is backing the Houthis against his own army and Al-Qaeda and the Muslim Brotherhood as well. That's why they have the curved daggers there in Yemen. There are some backstabbing. Reach button while you're standing behind them, they can still stab you in the back. Get it? Anyway, so, but then Hillary Clinton swoops in with the Arab Spring and she, oh, because someone tried to assassinate Saleh and he was wounded. It was a bomb attack and he was wounded and he had to go to the hospital in Saudi. So while he was out of town, Hillary Clinton swooped in and pushed him out and made his vice president the new dictator. But his vice president, a guy named Mansour Hadi, he did not have the, you know, kind of widespread agreements and deals with the different factions in the country to maintain power. And being a dictator of a country like Yemen is sort of like being Tony Soprano, where all day long you're basically making deals between your guys to keep them from killing each other. You know what I mean? So it's not the iron fist of a dictator. It's a desperate manager trying to hold the place together. So Hadi was incapable of doing that and was absolutely inept and slashed the gasoline ration subsidy and made hard state borders, which cut the Houthis off from the Red Sea, and it raised taxes. It refused to stand for election again after seizing power. And, you know, Hillary called it. Everybody can look this up. You'll find it. NPRnews.com even covered it, or .org, I guess. Type this into your thing if you want to look. Abdul Saleh ballot. And you'll see that in 2012, I mean, not Saleh, pardon me, Hadi, H-A-D-I, Hadi ballot. And when you do that, you'll see that there's just one name and one man and one face on the ballot to choose from, one oval to fill in. And Hillary Clinton called that the advent of Yemeni democracy, of course. But then he refused to stand for election after that. Well, also, Saleh had gone away mad. He didn't just retire to Mount Vernon to farm or whatever, like Cincinnati. He was like, oh, yeah, well, you can't fire me. I quit. And he took about 2/3 of his army with him. And then this was the joke, Tom, was it turned out that Saleh, the previous dictator, that is, he was actually a Zaydi Shiite from the north, too. He just wasn't a member of the Houthi tribe. But he had enough in common with them that when Hillary Clinton fired him, he went and took his army and went and joined up with the Houthis. And together, they were able to march on the capital city and seize control of it at the end of 2014. And even Barack Obama himself, on video, he says this to Thomas Friedman of the New York Times in a written but also videotaped interview. You could see the words coming right out of Barack Obama's mouth himself. He knows for a fact that Iran warned the Houthis not to take the capital city because you're going to freak out the Saudis and they're going to start a war against you. Don't do it. And the Houthis ignored the Iranians' advice and took over the capital city anyway. But even then, they were willing to negotiate. They knew that they did not have the juice to rule the whole country. And they were willing to compromise with all different factions. And they were willing to compromise with international actors, of course, especially the 800-ton gorilla on their northern border, the Saudis. But the Saudis just started bombing them anyway because, Tom, Barack Obama gave them a blank check at your expense and mine and said, we'll do whatever you want. You want all the planes you want, all the bombs you want, all the naval support for your evil blockade against the civilian population there, and mid-air refueling for your fighter bombers on their air campaign. And then, as we've discussed on your show previously, they wage an absolutely horrific Israel in Gaza-style campaign against the poor people of Yemen. They deliberately, the whole time, focused on attacking the civilian infrastructure, farms and marketplaces and fishermen's boats and flocks of sheep in the field and grain silos and irrigation ditches and any kind of factory, any kind of marketplace, auto dealerships. They did everything they could to completely disrupt civilian patterns of life and the ability of the people to sustain themselves. They took the central bank and took it down to Aden so they couldn't pay the salaries of any of the civil service employees. So there's no garbage collection. They're bombing the water, the sewage, the electricity, and then all the civil service workers who could try to put it back together, they can't get paid, so they can't go to work. They got to try to find something else to do. And the whole thing, you know, you two want to talk about genocide. This is where I'm perfectly happy to use that term because I don't know what else you call it when a nation or a group of nations deliberately inflict a famine on another nation. And that is what America, Saudi, UAE, and Al-Qaeda in that alliance did to the people of Yemen, starving them to death by the hundreds of thousands, depriving them to death by the hundreds of thousands. There's a massive cholera outbreak. They bombed the cholera hospital. And the official number, according to the UN, is 377,000 dead. But the total excess death rate, if they ever calculate it, I guarantee is going to be in the high hundreds of thousands killed in that thing. And that is, by the way, part of what's happening in Gaza now as well, and this is part of the South Africans' case against the Israelis, is that they are denying the aid that the people desperately need. And people are already going hungry and are starving and are being deprived to death, deprived of medicine, and deprived of basic food and clean water in Gaza to death already. And so I don't know whether you want to go as far as calling it a genocide yet there or not, but same kind of policy in Yemen for years. I don't think there's any question. And then, so yeah, I'm sorry, might sound like one big rambling mess, but to me, you know, I got all the details in the book there. It really is one unbroken chain of intervention after intervention, trying to clean up and repair the mess that they made last time. Just as you said, exactly what they would do if we were talking about any other government program. I mean, look at the central bank. What is the central bank ever doing other than racing to try to fix what they screwed up last time? Oh no, Tom, there's too much inflation. We better raise up interest rates in order to cool everything off. Oh no, Tom, we caused a giant crash when we boosted up the interest rates. We better stimulate the economy by slashing the rates back down again and creating more money again. And that's all they can ever do is just go back and forth trying to overcorrect from the last thing that they completely screwed up. And it's the same thing here. I don't usually mention my family on these things, but I made my mom proofread enough already because I didn't have a real editor for that one. And she said to me, she was laughing and said, I lost track of how many times we changed sides. I couldn't remember if we were at 11 or 12. And so I gave up because that's what we're doing. We're just flip-flopping back and forth. We're back in the Sunnis, we're back in the Shiites. We're back in the Sunnis, we're back in the Shiites. And including even when the Sunnis are bin Laden's suicide bomber brigades. Hey, if Israel hates the Shiites more, that's America's mandate, Dom.
Scott, I think you just set a record. And I say that not disparagingly, but almost out of a place of awe, I'll say. Quick message on behalf of our sponsor, CrowdHealth. There's somebody out there who doesn't find American health insurance frustrating and expensive. I haven't met that person. Not to mention claims denials are becoming more common. Last year, 1 in 5 Obamacare claims were denied. And can I take a wild guess that in your particular case, dear listener, the Affordable Care Act hasn't actually made your care more affordable? Well, that's why CrowdHealth was created. It's not health insurance. It's a better way to pay for healthcare through crowdfunding. Because let's face it, your insurance policy is opaque and full of unpleasant surprises, and your premiums are going up every year. You wind up feeling taken advantage of. CrowdHealth is doing things differently. For $175 for an individual or $575 for a family of 4 or more, you'll get access to a community of people who are willing to help out in the event of an emergency. You'll get access to telemedicine visits, discounted prescriptions, and so much more, and without doctors' networks getting in the way. And of course, you'll join the crowd, a group of members just like you who want to help pay for each other's unexpected medical events. Let CrowdHealth help with your healthcare needs. Get started today for just $99 per month for your first 3 months. Go to joincrowdhealth.com/woods. CrowdHealth is not insurance. Learn more at joincrowdhealth.com/woods. That's joincrowdhealth.com/woods. Okay, so first of all, let me put aside the project you're working on now. If people read your book enough already, I think sometimes when they hear you, they say, boy, this guy knows just so, so much, but I could never master all this. If they read enough already, they're going to be able to follow. They're not going to have any prior knowledge. They're going to be able to follow exactly.
Right.
A follows from B, follows from C, no problem, right?
Yes. And in fact, thank you for asking that, Tom, because I've had something bothering me, which is a wonderfully and perfectly good faith comment on my Amazon page for the book, where the guy says, geez, I heard the audiobook and I loved it. And I couldn't wait to get my hands on the book so I could check all the footnotes. And there's no footnotes. Where's the footnotes? And he only gave me 3 out of 5 stars. And I went, rah, and I grinded my teeth. But the thing is, he's right. And there's a reason for that. There's a few reasons for that. One of them was I was running out of time and money, and I had to just get the dang thing done. And I thought that, well, I wrote Fool's Errand, and it already has 1,300 footnotes in it. So if anyone wants to see if I can prove a case about something, they can check Fool's Errand. And I do try to cite my sources in the text a lot. And I include a lot of block quotes, especially like when you get to the Syria section where I'm outright accusing Barack Obama of high treason and of Netanyahu of helping him and all that. I absolutely demonstrate it with their own words in the text there. So,
which, by the way, if you have a block quotation, you put a portion of it in quotation marks, enter it into a search engine, and the original pop right up.
Yeah, exactly. And quite frankly, the way I wrote it too, I try to be very specific in my claims so that essentially anything that I tell you ought to be searchable. I don't just say the neoconservatives supported it. I say this guy and this guy and this guy supported it this day of this month of this year when they wrote a letter that said X. You know what I mean? That's the way I write anyway. But then you could call this a rationalization, but it's actually true too. And this is something I talked about with my friend Gus Cantavero, who filmed kind of the video version of Enough Already for me, was I want to make it real easy. I want to make it so that the book is not for my people. The book is for my people to give to their people, right? It's for the fans of my show to be able to say to their Uncle Bob, hey, Uncle Bob, you know that guy I'm always telling you about? Here, his book is finally done. It's 300 pages, knock it out, one and done. You know, you'll be done on Sunday, be started on Saturday morning, and then tell me what you think after that. And that's what it's made for, is to be, and that's one of the things I know is tough about Fool's Errand, is there's so many, that's my Afghanistan book, there's so many footnotes that it kind of interrupts the flow when there's a number on every word and you have to check the bottom of the page on everything. My current book has 3,500 and some footnotes already.
But you can help the reader out sometimes by just making them endnotes, and so they're not on the page.
Nah, I don't like that. I'm a Creature from Jekyll Island guy, and I like the way Griffin puts them right there at the bottom of the page so I can check his work, you know? I hate having to flip to the back. It kills me, man. But here's the point, though, is in Enough Already, you don't have to flip to the back or look at the bottom of the page. And it is written, it's sort of like Kevin Nealon would say, like, hear me now, believe me later. It's not even that. It's, you know, hear me now, know it later when you double check it if you want. You know what I mean? But at least hear me out. And that's what the story is. It's from Jimmy Carter through the end of Donald Trump. And it's explaining how one intervention led to the next intervention, led to the next intervention, led to the next intervention. And you can tell I'm not a partisan. I'm a libertarian. And I don't hold any of these presidents in any regard. Or I admit I hate Bill Clinton and W. Bush more than the rest. But you can see there, that's a bipartisan thing, right? That's like more personal than anything. And you know what? I'll tell you a story, Tom, if you want. I was at a Ron Paul event. I gave a speech at a Ron Paul event. I'm pretty sure this would have been 2019. And one of your guys came up to me at the end, one of your members of your audience came up to me at the end and said, sorry if I'm repeating myself. I don't remember what I say to who. So if I said this on your show before, I'll be embarrassed. But he said to me, you know, of all of Tom Wood's guests, I get the biggest problem with you. And I said, well, you know, I rub people the wrong way sometimes. You know what I mean? Like, I'm cool. I understand that. You know what I mean? I'm not everybody's cup of tea, pal. It doesn't hurt my feelings. I apologize to you. You know what I mean? Burden's on me to be likable enough. And he said, no, that's not it. He goes, that's not it. He goes, the problem is that I had to admit that I was wrong about everything. And he says, my dad and me and my brothers, we're all Reaganites. We're all right-wingers, and we've all supported every single thing that you're against. We've supported this whole time. And when the Democrats do one, we go, well, at least he's doing that, even though we don't like anything else about him. And now Tom Woods is telling me, hey, listen up to this guy. He's right about everything. Go ahead, tell him, Scott. And then you're telling me that I'm wrong about everything, but Tom is telling me that you're right. So now I got to do the work. I got to hear you out, and I got to be fair, right? This ain't Noam Chomsky. This is something else. So what is it? What the hell? And then I think he read the book. Must have been. Oh, no, because this would have been 2019. So this would have been. Maybe he only read Fool's Errand. This would have been before Enough Already was done. But anyway, and he says, like, yeah, that was it. But it was a hard pill to swallow. And like, he was a little like, I could tell he was a little emotional about it. He said something, I hope I'm paraphrasing this fairly. I believe he said something like, look, I had to go tell my old dad and my brothers, we were wrong. This is what's true. And sorry, it sucks, but it is what it is. Read this book. It'll mess you up too, but you know, that's what, it ain't right what we're doing, man. It hasn't been this whole time. And if it was any other power doing the same thing, we'd be first in line to condemn it. So like, what are you going to do? And I'm proud of that because I think, you know, I didn't write any of these books in a way, Tom, where like I'm pandering, where I pretend to be more right wing than I am, where I pretend to like idolize the soldiers or any kind of thing like that. But just the truth is that I am a patriot. And I'm not a leftist. And I like soldiers. I've known army guys my whole life long, including, you know, my grandfather fought in 3 wars. And, you know, just like everybody in America's family has had something to do with this, especially go back to the world wars and all that. And so it's not that I'm like kissing everybody's rear end. It's just that I'm not a leftist. And that's basically good enough. You read it and you can tell this is not, you know, I cite Russell Kirk saying, it doesn't have to be this way. We shouldn't be doing this. instead of citing Noam Chomsky saying it doesn't, we shouldn't be doing this. You know what I mean? So I hope that makes it like easier for people to at least be willing to hear me out. And then I think if you read it, I got to say, man, I don't get much dissension. I've given a lot of speeches, especially because the LP will have me around. I've given a lot of speeches. I know this isn't a random sample, but man, I've had a lot of soldiers come up to me and none of them ever mad, right? Including when I was on your cruise. There were three guys. One of them was a Ranger. One of them was a Green Beret. And one of them was something else, maybe a Marine. And they were like, hey, we all fought in the war, Horton. And I'm like, uh-oh. And they're like, man, we love your book so much. We agree with everything. And we learned so much and da-da-da-da-da. And I was like, phew, man. You know, I had a guy, I remember in San Marcos, I did a libertarian event. And a guy came up to me and said, listen, I was a special forces intelligence in the region. And I was basically like sitting overseeing everything that you describe. And I just want to tell you, you're right about everything. And I learned a lot. Everything that I know confirms what you say. And plus, also, I learned more from you. But there ain't a thing that I learned in a decade over there on the job being a special forces intelligence officer that I would then, based on that, tell you that you don't know what you're talking about. Yes, you do too. Like, that's it. And I get that from colonels and CIA guys and Army and Marine Corps veterans and things like that all the time. And yeah, I'm real proud of that. And I hope that new people will take that as a hint that maybe it's okay. Oh, I got one more real short one. A guy said to me about a year ago, he said to me, I gave your book to my dad. And he goes, oh, what's this? Some kind of commie thing. And then he turned it over. And at the top of the back of the book, it says, this book is good. Daniel Davis, Lieutenant Colonel, Bronze Star winner, Iraq War I, Iraq War II, Afghanistan veteran. And then he said, my old dad said, well, if the colonel says it's okay, I guess I'll read it. So that's my story, you know?
Yeah. That look, whatever works to get somebody to open his mind and think. Well, Scott, as I want to wrap up, but I want to know of all the things that you do, because now you got antiwar.com, you got the Libertarian Institute, you got your books, you got scotthorton.org. What's one place, one action item for people to take for Scott Horton material? What should they do next?
Well, I guess sign up for the podcast feed, either at scotthorton.org or at youtube.com/scotthortonshow. And then that way you get the update. I'm pretty much doing shows one day a week, but I do 3 or 4 usually per week. You can stay up to date that way. And then, well, that's one thing. Of course, antiwar.com and Libertarian Institute, we got the bad news for you and the best writers on it all day, every single day, 365 days a year.
All right, excellent. And my gosh, antiwar.com has now been around for, I guess, going on 28 years. It's absolutely crazy that they nabbed that domain name so early, antiwar.com. And that wound up in good hands, so.
Yeah, you know what? The first time, I'll never forget, the first time I ever saw it was in 1999 during my first radio show. It was called Say It Ain't So on Free Radio Austin. And my friend Shauna goes, hey, look at this. And it's antiwar.com. It's in big red letters at the top. And I go, what's that? Some kind of commie thing? And she goes, no, check it out. And she pages down and right there, they got a link to an article by Ron Paul. And I go, oh, wow, really cool. And she clicks a couple things. And this wasn't even on antiwar.com, but she clicks a couple things and there's a link to an article by L. Neil Smith called Lincoln, the American Lenin. And I'm like, wow, cool. These are like right-wing hardcore libertarians, man. I like it, dude. And they own antiwar.com. And then you look at like the More Viewpoints page and it has For a New Isolationism by Murray Rothbard at the bottom and Rise of Empire by Garrett Garrett. And this is like, oh man, I can't believe this stuff because I'd already read The People's Pottage because I got my John Bircher influences previous to that. So I was like, wow, these guys know about Ron Paul and Garrett Garrett and all this. Who's this Rothbard guy? This is awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely true. All right. Well, so everybody I'm going to put links and stuff as usual on the show notes page. That's tomwoods.com/2442. Also in the description of the video. Scott, I appreciate you talking to me, but now you got to get back to work because you got a book to finish.
Absolutely, I do. Thank you so much, Tom, for having me again.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.